My name is Michelle O'Hagan.
And Michelle, can you tell us a little bit how you started in your career?
I started when I was 20 years old, and I studied film and television in Tel Aviv University and started making movies right away. I wasn't really much of a theory student. I wanted to be in the field. And there were plenty of subjects to cover at the time in Israel. So I started immediately with burning issues of the country and never stopped since.
Okay. Is that what that was your first project that you ended up doing?
Well, I made my first movie when I was 20 years old. It was a love story between an Arab and a Jew under the circumstances of the conflict, which unfortunately is still there. And that was a very taboo subject because of the tensions between the two cultures. And I wanted to try and bridge that by showing that we're all humans and we all love and we all have prejudices that we can actually overcome. Okay. So that was that launched my career, actually.
Gotcha. And that how do you kind of like, you know, you're 20 years old, I think you said. So how do you, you know, find the money and the time and like everything else to kind of just say, I'm going to go forward and do this project?
So the first project was very difficult because I was still, a student at the university. I basically went to, and I wanted to do a bigger film than just like a student film. I love big production. I love production value. So outside of the very little resources that the school had, you know, we had an old camera and we were all fighting over that one camera. I decided to go to friends and family and say, look, this film is important. It's relevant. Did a lot of legwork, went to all kinds of, you know, boring conferences and hustled. And at some point I thought, that's it. I can't make this movie the way I want to make it. And I don't want to compromise. And then out of the blue came this angel, as it always happens, who wrote me a check and said, you know, this film is important. And I was able to film, but at that time we were still shooting on film. So you still have to go to the lab and develop and watch. But I didn't have the money to develop the film. So I shot the whole movie, but didn't see one frame of it. It's not like today you shoot and you can see on video what you're shooting. I didn't see anything for almost a year until I started raising money again, until I got the money to actually develop the film and see what I shot. So I didn't know if I had a movie. I didn't know how it came out. I didn't know how it looked. It was a big mystery. And I was obviously very anxious because I didn't know if all my efforts were on the film. So I finally found a sponsor actually in New York. I was still living in Israel, who believed in the cause and gave me the money to develop it. And it turned out to be, you know, a really nice film, got a lot of awards. So persistence really got me there, to be honest.
Gotcha. What was the name of that film? Is that The Wonderful
Life? It was called
Life?
Pressure.
Pressure?
No, that was before. Pressure was actually a narrative film. But what I did in order to make it very authentic, I took my actress, my Israeli actress, and planted her in an Arab village that was there. And the people she met were real people. So I wanted to get her reaction, you know, as a Jewish woman coming to an Arab village. I wanted to get her authentic reaction instead of using all actors and extras. And that worked really well.
Gotcha. And what do you think, growing up gave you that ability to kind of push forward even when stuff's happening? Meaning, like, how do you go from like, I shot the whole film, now I have no money to develop it, but I'm going to still keep going and I'm going to still, and I'm sure people are telling you at the time, like, this is not what you should be doing. This isn't, you know, you should be a doctor or a lawyer. That's kind of what we always hear from family members and stuff like that. So what kind of makes you push forward?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, honestly, even though I come from a Jewish family where they do mostly want you to be a doctor and lawyer, that was never on the radar for me. I always, you know, I started directing theater when I was 12 years old. I would gather all my friends and, you know, write something. I don't know what I wrote. It was probably ridiculous, but we still acted it out. And I knew I wanted to direct, and that's all I wanted. And my parents knew it. And so they were not very surprised when I said I wanted to learn film and television. My parents were film buffs. And so I grew up watching French movies and old movies and going to theater. They were very cultural. And so it wasn't that kind of a struggle. The struggle was more a financial struggle because they couldn't afford to put me in university. So I had to work nights. So I would go finish school at about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. I would go to a restaurant, work at the bar until 2 in the morning, wash the floors. By the time I got home, it was 3 in the morning, 8 a.m., I would be on the bus to school. Because there was no campus. The campus, it was also only for foreign students. So we actually had to, if your parents didn't live in town, which my parents didn't, I had to rent a place and have roommates and pay for it. So I was literally falling asleep during classes. I was very tired. But the drive and the idea that I am an immigrant. I am a multiple-time immigrant. I was born in Morocco, in Casablanca, and we immigrated to Israel. So I was an immigrant. And I wanted to prove myself. I wanted to show that I'm like everybody else, if not better. And just a note, as a woman in the business, especially at that time, was less difficult in Israel. But when I came to Los Angeles in the 80s, it was very hard to find any kind of work as a female director, let alone representation. Like, I remember calling agents, and I had already a body of work when I came here, and calling agents, and they would tell me, well, you know, we already have one female director, so we can't have more. And I was like, well, how many male do you have? A lot. So that was the second struggle coming here to the United States. In Israel, it's not really a big issue because both men and women go to the army, so we have an equal kind of responsibility. So that was never an issue, but in America it is, still is a little bit.
So when you're here are you here in the States when you produce Color Straight Up?
Yes. So I came here and I started, I wanted to make a big feature. I dreamt of being, you know, Steven Spielberg at the age of 25. Of course, that didn't happen, but I took a turn because I saw a lot of homeless women who were living out of their cars. And I was like, I am here in America, one of the richest countries in the world. And I see women living out of their cars, women who could be like my mother. So I was really moved and really shocked. And I started researching and ended up making a movie about it called It Was a Wonderful Life that was narrated by Jodie Foster with music by Melissa Etheridge. And then the riots happened. And again, I wanted to go down to South Central and see with my own eyes what was going on. And I realized that there were a lot of amazing kids who were at risk, who needed just a push to finish school and graduate. And I found out about this arts program that basically offered after school performing arts for at-risk youth, mainly from Jordan High School, in the middle of gangland. And I spent 4 years following them around once I established trust. It was very risky to shoot there, especially after dark. But we were so committed to tell the stories of those kids who are really trying to stay in school despite the circumstances, despite, you know, having brothers and sisters in gangs or in rehab or in jail, having no role models to look up to. I wanted to shed a positive light on South Central LA. And so we filmed their performance and how they found a safe place on stage. And actually they all graduated high school and some of them even went to college, which was really unheard of. They were the first in the families to do so. So that was, that's the one that was nominated for an Academy Award. I took all the kids from South Central who were in the movie to the Academy Awards. That was kind of a sight. Got them tuxedos and makeup and hair, and we all walked on the red carpet.
And do you do that feature because you see something in you that was kind of them, meaning like, you know, maybe not the same place that they're living, but, you know, being able to find art and kind of like be able to attach to that and kind of get yourself out of a situation?
Very much so. You know, I usually like to tell stories of the underdog and give voice to people who may not have a loud voice in society. And I include myself in that. Being an immigrant always puts you in a disadvantage in terms of feeling like you don't belong and your culture is different from the main culture and your language is different. You know, my mother language is French. So I never felt that I really belong. And I think that those kids felt the same, that even though they were born in the United States, they were still underprivileged and didn't have the resources that most kids their age have. Plus being in a real, like a war zone doesn't help, where you go outside and it's at your own risk. And so the arts was the way out. And yes, I never made that connection. But now that you said that, I realized that art was my way of proving myself and making a place for myself, because I always knew that I wanted to stand out. I didn't want to be another, you know, doctor. And I wanted to stand out. I wanted to put my mark in history for my people. And so being having those cultural barriers, and sometimes even some kind of discrimination, you always, as an immigrant, feel some kind of, from some people, because you're not a native, really motivated me to show that we too have a voice, and a very strong one. And I think you're right. I think the kids have reflected my own journey in their own way.
And once you kind of get nominated for an Academy Award, does your life change? Like, those agents that you were calling, are they starting to call you and to sign you?
Yes. Oh my God. I was invited to dinners. The head of the agency were literally fighting over me. Like, I'm sending you a limo. You're going to come meet the head of this and this agency. Do not sign with them, the other one, because they're never going to do anything for you, etc. I was also developing a feature with MGM based on the documentary Color Straight Up. And Morgan Freeman was attached. He was both producing with me and his partner, Lori, and also playing one of the teachers that are portrayed in Color Straight Up. So we were a big force, and I was courted right and left. I finally signed with, at the time it was Endeavor, because they, you know, I felt they would do the best for me, and they were really amazing. I was, for 2 years, I was just running from meeting to meeting. We want to work with you. What do you have? But at the same time, I also did an educational campaign with Color Straight Up. So I would travel with the kids in the movie to schools, both, you know, very wealthy schools like at the Palisades, and very hardcore schools in New York, for example, that had a lot of gang kids, to basically show the film and show the kids that they too can, you know, make something of their lives with a little help. And so they could identify with the kids, and then they could ask them questions after. That was amazing. And that educational campaign was funded by the actor, Dustin Hoffman, who generously, after he saw the movie in the theater, actually called me and he said, "What can I do?" And I said, "You can do this. I need you to fund this campaign." And he did. And we had many screenings with many celebrities who lent their voices and hosted, you know, Dustin, Morgan, many others. And that was a wonderful ride, especially because, you know, when you think of South Central LA, Watts, you think about violence, you think about drive-bys, you think about helicopters and ambulances, and it's all true. And I wanted to show something else that's coming out of the neighborhood. I wanted to show hope. I wanted to show that the arts can help you, pull you through. Even if you don't want to be a dancer or a singer, it doesn't matter. You use that as a tool to get out. And we had a saying that the kids were a hug away from improvement in their lives, which they got from those two inspirational teachers that I featured, one Black and one white, who were running this after school program. So I wanted to show that there are good things happening with those teens, that there is hope, that there is a way out, that they are not doomed. And we even, you know, during the Oscars, we send them a white limo, and literally both the Bloods and the Crips, for once, maybe in history, were standing together saluting those kids who were going to the Oscars, and thanking the opportunity that for once the press came not to show a drive-by, but to show a success story. And that was very moving. And that meant a lot to me, as well as walking on the red carpet. But when we didn't win the Oscar, they all stood up and walked away from the auditorium in the protest. Like, you know, they just left. They were bad losers.
So from there, obviously you probably start going into like the studio system, which usually takes a long time to get anything processed or done. So how do you kind of feel after that project? Like, what are you doing? Because I'm guessing before that project, you were just like, I'm going to pick up a camera and do whatever I need to do. And after that project comes out, I'm sure you have agents and everybody telling you like, no, we have to go through this and we have to go through that. And now it's just, I'm guessing, waiting. So what kind of happens after this?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a long journey. I really wanted to do a feature film with MGM, but I had to go through so many hoops. It was a $20 million film with actors. And again, being a female director, I would have been, the film didn't happen finally, but I would have been the fourth female director in the history of MGM. And I had to go through so many hoops and proving that I can do this and show them storyboards and show them a deck and show them this and show them that. And by the way, I was also pregnant at the time. So imagine a, you know, 7 months pregnant woman walking into an executive's room with 8 male executives, trying to convince them that I can run a $20 million film. That was like an impossible task. And plus, I was nauseous all the time. I was like, you know, barely functioning. But I did. And it took, you know, the final seal was Morgan Freeman calling the head of the studio and say, listen, I know she can direct. I saw her movie. That's why I'm here. So that's it. End of story. And that sealed the deal. And we went into production. And 6 weeks before we started shooting, we were already casting. It was a musical. We had choreographers. We had dancers. We had amazing people. Everybody called me to be in this film because of the, you know, it was very inspirational. And then MGM pulled the plug. They were sinking. It was, you know, at least 15 years ago. They were sinking and they couldn't afford it. Instead, they chose to do their last film at the time. It was Soul Plane, the Snoop Dogg film, which was, you know, not great.
How do you kind of feel at this point? Because obviously, you know, that's a huge opportunity for you. And it's also, you know, the fourth female director to do kind of a movie out of that studio. And it's very big situation, I think, for all female directors, because I think even now today, it's still hard for female directors to kind of get into a film. So how are you feeling and how do you kind of overpass that? Because I feel like that's a pretty big hit.
I think, you know, so there were stages in that. So the first stage was like, as a woman, you had to prove that you can be like a man. So if I would walk into a room and try to get a job and, pitch my movie or my take on a movie, you would not see this lipstick on. You would not see, I would almost dress like to look like hardcore to convince them that I can run a set. Which was really difficult for me because I don't like to like disguise myself, but in a way I had to, because that was my only way to show that, you know, I'm not like a soft, weak, I can direct action movies, I can direct anything. It was hard. Many times I did not get the job, even if I was more qualified than the male that was also up for the job. It was frustrating, very frustrating. And many times I was like, that's it. I'm not doing this anymore. It's useless. I'm up against, you know, something I can't win. But at the same time, the drive to make movies was stronger than the outside circumstances. It's like it's a calling. It's like so many times I wanted to just stop and like, oh, I can do something much simpler. I don't need to do this. But you can't. It's just, it's in your DNA. And so pushing forward, I really wanted to unconsciously pave the way for others. And I feel like I have, together with my colleagues, because if we were to give up, then the next generation will not be able to make movies. And this next generation of talented women. So I co-founded an organization called Cine Women, where women in the industry would gather and give each other jobs and networks. So we felt like we have a community to go to and that we're only women. And that was great. But I also, you know, the desire to make a movie surpassed everything. So I went back to documentaries after MGM shut us down and said, I don't want to deal with studios. I don't want to deal with this. Then I made a very successful movie called Cowboy de l'Amour, which won by Southwest both the jury and the audience award, was picked up by Focus Films to develop a feature. So almost every doc I made was developed into a script. And by then I had such a body of work that it was hard for them to refuse me. But to be honest, the biggest break I had was when Ted Sarandos from Netflix, a few years after they started Netflix, called me at home And he said, hey, my name is Ted Torrendes. I have this company called Netflix. We have these videos that we put in red envelopes and we mail to people. We have a million subscribers. And can you give me the movies that, you know, you have? I said, well, yeah, I had 2-3 movies by then. I was like, but you know, they already aired everywhere. Showtime, HBO, not HBO, PBS, whatever. So do you really want it? Everybody already saw it. It's like, yeah, I want it because we're going to, you know, just do it on video. I was like, okay. So I think he gave me $1,000. I sent it to him. And that was the beginning of a long lasting relationship with Netflix because I was one of the first documentary filmmakers to trust them. I had no idea what it was. And after that, we did a movie together called Steal a Pencil for Me. They co-founded it. They released, Cowboy de l'Amour was the first documentary that they released in theaters. So we had the same day we released in theaters and on their platform. So we did a lot of innovative things together at the beginning years of Netflix. And they picked up Cabo de l'Amour at South By, and I didn't want to give it to them. I said, well, I don't want to go on DVD. I want to go to the theaters. You know, at that time, theaters was a big deal and an Oscar qualifier. So they said, you know what? Okay, we'll do that. We will finance the theatrical release if you give us afterwards the DVD rights. And that's what we did. And we had a wonderful collaboration. And from then on, I think almost every movie I made ended up on Netflix. I did an original film for them 2 years ago called Strip Down, Rise Up that is still streaming on Netflix. It's about how sensual dance can connect you to your femininity. And it's a lot about pole dancing and not what you think of pole dancing, but more like as a way of healing. And it's for everyone. And also pole dancing is a sport. And this last film I actually did for HBO. Sometimes I work for hire. By now, I'm hired as like the state elder to oversee the young directors and to guide them through production. And so it was a wonderful collaboration with a director called Cassius Corrigan. We made a sport doc called The Unbreakable Tatiana Suarez. Again, you know, a Latina who had difficult circumstances, was a female wrestler, had cancer, overcame, and went back to the arena, became a UFC champion. And we were filming her comeback as an MMA fighter because she couldn't wrestle anymore due to her injuries. So all my stories, again, tell an entertaining story, but has a kind of a desire to belong and to be somebody because of the way we were brought up. Whether it's, you know, immigration or discrimination or in some cases, not mine, but others, abuse as women, the empowerment of women is very important to me. It's a very subtle layer in my films, but it is important to me because I had to empower myself. I had no mentors. I had very loving parents who encouraged me, but that's kind of about it. I, as a pioneer in the industry in Israel, I had no one to look up to. Definitely not women. So... Yeah, go ahead.
No, what I was going to ask you is there any situations that you were into on any of your films that you kind of had to overcome? I mean, I know, you know, recording out on Watts and that area is probably pretty scary. I don't know if any situations happened or is there any other situations like we had a filmmaker on here that accidentally deleted all the footage of like a really big video one time after he finished and he had to figure out how to come up with the money afterwards to shoot it again for and pay it out of pocket. Is there any situations that kind of happened to you on any of your films?
Yeah. So in Curl Straight Up, one of the kids I was filming did something bad because, you know, they trip sometimes. And before I started filming, I told everybody, if something happens in your life, call me. Even if it's in the middle of the night, call me. I want to come and film. So I get a call from this kid named Oscar and he said, Michelle, this is my only call from jail. Can you come bail me? I'm like, okay, I'm going to try, but meanwhile, I want to film you. So this is 3 a.m. I have a freshly born baby and my husband is also my DP. So I'm like, okay, if I take my husband as a DP, I can't leave the baby alone. So what do? I can't send my husband because I want to be there. So I took the camera myself and drove to the court, to jail, LA County Jail. Waited till the morning because they won't let me see him. And then they brought him to court in this orange suit tied to two other inmates. So now I have a camera and I want to film, but I'm in a court, so you can't really do that. So I put my, it was a very little camera, a little HD. I put it in my backpack, and to get into court, they scanned it and they didn't catch it. I'm like, okay, I'm safe. So now I'm in the courtroom and I want to film Oscar's trial. And I can't just bring the camera out. I mean, security guys will basically jump on me. And by the way, I'm a very shy person. Not when I'm directing, but in real life, I'm very shy. So I'm like raising my hand, very, you know, shaky hand. And I was like, Your Honor, may I approach the bench? And he looks at me like, what? Who is she? Why is she? But he was very nice. So I approached the bench and I said, his name was Judge Morris. I said, Judge Morris, I just want to tell you, I'm making this film. And Oscar is one of my characters in the film. And I want to show how they can come out of their situation, even though. And he's like, he looks at me. And for a moment, I thought he was going to just kick me out. And he's like, come back to my chambers. I'm like, okay, I'm in trouble. I go back to my chambers with one of the teachers who were there as well. And he goes, you don't understand. You guys are everything I've been waiting for my entire life. This is how I want to help. What can I do? I said, I just want to film Oscar. He said, I can't let you do that because he's tied to two other inmates and you don't have permission to film them. And right now meanwhile, they put him back in a cage, basically. He said, you can't even see him. I said, well, then you're not being helpful to me. So what can you do? He said, I don't know. I said, well, can you see him? And he goes, yeah, of course I can see him. I'm the judge. I'm like, all right, here's my camera. You go film it. He's like, I don't know what to use the camera. I'm like, I'm going to show you how to do it. So I showed him how to use the camera. And the judge literally walks with the camera into jail, films Oscar. I told him which shots I needed. Films Oscar, comes back, gives me the footage, and gives me an interview. So the situation turned 100%. But for a moment, I was like, I don't have a shot. I'm kicked out of the court. And those are the magic moments where you meet people who get it and understand what we're trying to do and understand that in this case, these kids need any help they can get. So that was wonderful. In other incident, when Oscar actually did go to jail, he was a trouble kid. It took us 6 months to get permission to film in this juvenile detention center. 6 months, we finally get permission. We go in and we film. Again, I told you I was shooting on 16 millimeter. Great footage, great stuff. We come back to the van and the AC, the assistant camera, you know, they have to take the film out in the dark and then, you know, put it in a safe place. So the AC opens the van and she looks at me and she's like pale. I'm like, what happened? She goes, Michelle, I did not completely seal the area. So when I opened the magazine where the film is, then the negative, it was exposed to light. I was like, come again? Did you say that everything we shot in the jail was exposed to light? She says, yes. I thought I was going to die. I couldn't go back to film, obviously. That was that. I had no more film. And so immediately I sent it to the lab and I said, do what you can to save it. So half of it was gone and half of it had this light coming in on the side, but you could still see what was happening. So I could use that and I blew up the image to get rid of the light, that the light flickers. So it was still, you know, I had enough to use, but it was absolutely devastating. And by the way, it happens with HD too. I had a situation where I followed an old couple. They went back to a concentration camp after they were liberated and they were now in their, you know, 80s. And we went back to Holland and we visited the camp and we had an incredible scene that we filmed. And this was the first film that I shot on HD cards. I was one of the first ones to try it out. And somehow the card got, I don't know, mixed up with other cards and we shot over the scene. And so I lost one of the most precious scenes I ever shot in my life. And of course, that was devastating, but you have to deal with it because in documentaries, you don't have another take. You only have one take. So that was it. Yeah.
And is there anything you're working on today that you're trying to get going?
Yes, I have several projects that I'm developing, and yes, I have an agent at WME, and they're helping me a lot. So I do both for higher projects, like I told you, the HBO one. And this one I'm producing about a spiritual path. We got a rare access. I can't really talk about it yet, but it is a very interesting way of how during the circumstances and everything that's going on in the world right now, you can still keep your authentic self and your spirituality and not react to what's happening, but rather stay true to yourself. That's what this is about. I'm also developing another project with Morgan Freeman's company, an interracial love story. I have a bunch of stuff. I have two game shows I'm developing. I have a food documentary I'm developing. I'm very busy, but I also am very picky. I always was. I only want to make movies that contribute to healing the world. I'm not interested in violence and murders and whodunit and true crimes, all that stuff, which is very much what people are looking for, the buyers. It's a very difficult time to sell anything today unless it's like a documentary about a celebrity or a sports celebrity or like a tentpole doc. Very hard to sell. Even with everything I've done, it used to be that the buyers were looking for awards. Now they're looking for eyeballs, basically. So it's a very hard time for our industry.
And my last question would be, you know, what advice would you give to like a new filmmaker trying to break into the industry?
The means to film right now are so simple and so accessible and so cheap that I would say just take your camera and start filming what you want to film. You don't need a lot of money anymore to shoot. And once you have completed your story, use that as a calling card to show what you can do. And I would say a lot of young filmmakers want to shoot something to get an agent. So they are trying to do something very slick and very like showy that is not authentic to who they are. And that never works. So my advice is stay true to yourself and to your story. Work from your gut and your instincts. Tell the best story you can tell with the best means you can, but it doesn't have to be flashy, even if it's very simple on your iPhone, and show what you can do and keep doing the craft, keep doing and keep going out there and filming. Never stop and don't let people tell you you can't do it or don't do it this way or do it that way. Compromises you will have to make for the buyers, but not to the core of what you're doing. So keep doing it, basically, is my best advice.